But this is the cake. Scotty cake.
What's the image of?
That's Scotty in a porn shoot from the 50s.
All right.
Being presented to him by a modern. And I think she was there with Svetlana.
Yes.
Right?
Okay. Yes.
Well, anyway, they were very sweet to come to the show.
Yeah. I wanted to get her honest...
yeah, she posted.
Yeah.
I saw.
Yeah.
That was great.
Yeah. So the... I read in another review somewhere or some that Scotty's wife has moved to Texas.
Well, she is unwell. She had a fracture of the spine, and then
when did that happen?
I think she had a fall. I don't really know the details actually, but then she had an arthritic kind of side effect from that, and.
Hmm.
Her daughter wanted her to have some special attention. So, meanwhile, the daughter got a job in Houston, so Lois went with her. But this has just happened a few days ago.
Okay.
It's all new. Yeah, Scotty's all right. Not happy. He wants to be with her.
Yeah. Well, I'm sorry she's what, in her 80s?
She's 85, he's 95. All it's right. Hard on him because he doesn't want to be separated from her, but the daughter... thought it would be best, and then the job was a surprise, I guess.
Right. Let's see if I can get this.
So that's the situation.
Okay. What has been the most, you've got quite a few screenings in the last couple of weeks. What has been the most, heartening and made you feel the best?
Two things. That's a good question. No one's asked me that yet. Two things I can respond immediately to. And and together they especially hearten me. The first are the two LGBTQ festivals we did in California, Outfest and Frameline, Outfest in LA and Frameline in San Francisco. Sold out, people turned away, standing room only, standing ovations, and the overwhelming response from that community for this film and the way and perceiving what the film and Scotty means to them in that audience is very moving to me. He's an icon to a certain generation of LGBTQ person. The audiences have been mostly male, but they've also been female and some lesbian presence as well at the gay festivals.
Mm.
And that has been overwhelming and very gratifying. With that, having a huge attendance at the theatrical premiere, which is not a gay audience necessarily, but obviously open to anyone.
This and is the Arclight thing.
The Arclight, where we, as you saw the number, which was huge, showing that we could thrill a general audience and have that kind of turnout for the film. Those two things together have been fairly overwhelming for me. I'm so thrilled that the film's connecting with all audiences and Scotty being 95 and being able to be at all these shows is really exciting to watch. He's fairly levitating. It's a victory lap for him.
Whenever I have written about it, there's always this percentage of people that respond, And I don't know how to respond to them, except that I, after really listening to his friends, I believe the emotions of his friends. I don't believe that they're lying for him or with him. I don't think he's lying, but I believed everything because of all the love between he and his and the guys who are still with him, still with us.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know how to say that to people, but they still come up with this. But you said something in so many words to the New York Times, quote, it all adds up.
Mm-hmm.
I know you've been asked this 85 times, but could you do a summary?
Sure. Well, the first thing I asked Audie when I met him and we started to do a 2-year Cinema Verite shoot was, are there any people alive who were present at the gas station? And really, to my surprise, he said, oh, yes. And there's no inkling of this in his memoir at all, because it's his memoir and he doesn't interview people who were present at that time. It's his memories. And it's also, as you know, it was co-written. So he had a co-writer.
Yeah. So that guy was basically one who finessed the words, but not necessarily...
He took Scotty's stories and put them into a literary format, right? This was the most exciting thing I learned the whole time. I mean, forget the salacious gossip. To know that there were gas station boys still around seemed to me one of the best-kept secrets in Hollywood, second only to Scotty still being around. So we then immediately, the first order of business was to go visit whoever was alive who had been there, whomever was alive who had been there. And these guys are in their late 80s and 90s now. All told, I think I met 6 or 7 of the former hustlers, ranging in ages from early 90s down into their 60s. Mm. And they corroborated everything, first of all. Some of them had photographic evidence from the period. One of them had...
Brownie, automatic?
From a later period. Well, no, that's true. They're in the film. You can see it. There's the photo of Lee Shook, the first guy who was a sex worker. Mm. He's in his 55 Thunderbird with Scotty. Mm. That was a new Thunderbird in 55. Mm. And it was a brownie shot, quite frankly. So he had that. But Lee Shook also had an index card that was tantamount to the little black book of Scotty. It was 12 or 13 names of guys who were not world famous, but they were very known, mostly producers of live television in New York. Mm. And it was given to this particular guy when he was going on a trick in New York in case he needed other, as Scotty put it, other tricks to buy a ticket back home. Right. So everyone asks, including on CBS Sunday Morning, Anthony Mason, the correspondent, asks him, oh, well, did you have a little black book? Scotty says, no, the reason being that he didn't want the Vice Squad to find it. But in this index card was sort of like a specialty thing, and it is a page of the little black book recently, really. So the people who are the doubters, who are related to the pearl clutchers, I call them the doubters and the pearl clutchers, and sometimes they're the same person, I present to them physical evidence. It's in the film. You can see it.
Yeah.
These names are not obscure names. Robert Fryer was a very well-known producer of live television, and there are others on there. You can look them up on IMDb. And there's much, much more where that came from. So for me, finding men who were present at the time of the gas station, which, as Bill Mann states in the beginning of the film, seemed like urban legend because so many people had whispered about it over the years. The first person to whisper about it to me was Merv Griffin, who said, how he talked, oh, buddy, you know, there used to be this gas station on Hollywood Boulevard and you'd go there to get into trouble. Very Merv Griffin, right? Very much.
How far back was that when you heard that story
from Merv? I did a Vanity Fair profile of him in, I think, 2000. So that's, what is it, 18 years ago? Mm-hmm. Another gay senior statesman, Merv didn't identify as gay, but he apparently lived a double life, of Hollywood, told me about the gas station without naming Scotty. Mm. By the way, if you look in the literary record from the early 60s down, the gas station is mentioned. It's mentioned in City of Night by John Retchie.
Okay.
It's mentioned in a James Ellroy novel. It's mentioned in Armistead Maupin's Maybe the Moon. And Maupin himself told me that. Huh. Maupin heard about Scotty from Rock Hudson. John Schlesinger's boyfriend, Michael Childers, who's in the movie, was there in the 60s and corroborated and said that he met Scotty with Rock Hudson at a house party in that period. Mm. So the corroboration's everywhere. All you needed to do is look. The people who are doubters, I think, are straight washers who they want to continue, for whatever perverse reason, to sanitize the history of Hollywood. What, that they have a stake in that? I don't understand. It's actually so pervasive, and it's come up so much now that it's sort of thrillingly perverse at this point. And I think these people should be derided for their prudery and their denial of history. There's a film teacher somewhere named Jeanine Basinger who was quoted in the New York Times as saying that this was shenanigans and that people should get a life. I don't understand how someone that professes to teach the history of Hollywood would or should think that straight washing iconic Hollywood movie stars who are historical figures is a wise thing to do.
Is there any, did you ever think to maybe talk, who was the one who wrote the most, the ripest Cary Grant biography? Was it Charles Higham?
I've heard of that one, yeah.
H-I-G-H-A-M.
Yeah, I know that one. Well, William Mann is a scholar, and historian, and biographer of that period of Hollywood. Who is gay and has a LGBTQ slant, well, not unless let's say the word slant, lens on Hollywood. And he's quite authoritative. His book, Kate, was the one that really sought to correct the record about Tracy and Hepburn.
Okay. Double take that I had was Spencer Tracy.
Mm-hmm.
I just never, everybody, just about everybody in the community, as it were, Scottish community,
right?
You can feel Rock Hudson, you can feel Cary Grant, you can feel a lot of it, but Tracy, he seemed so gruff and kind of, sardonic, and he was always the drinker, and I understand that fits a certain type that doesn't like to acknowledge, but he goes there in a certain...
Sure. I mean, I've never been a big believer in the so-called homosexual personality.
Yeah. Charles Laughton, you can kind of sense it. There's a there's a vibe about him. There's a vibe about a lot of guys.
There are a lot of people who are gay or bisexual who don't read that way.
Yeah.
I don't see why Spencer Tracy should be in the special category. If Scotty, first of all, he was a friend of Cukor's and he was living in that house, and Scotty was around that house all the time. Liz Smith in the film, who knew Hepburn and virtually lived with her in a townhouse in New York City, confirms on camera in the film Hepburn's lesbianism or bisexuality. And Liz, off camera, spoke to Tracy as well. I have nothing else to say other than I'm just reporting the facts as I heard them. And also, I will say that Bill Mann spoke to Cukor's secretaries, who have since died, who confirmed the Tracy information for him as well.
The first meeting I had with Scotty was at Whole Foods, I think I told him.
Oh, yeah.
He goes there to just, the
bar, salad bar.
And I just introduced myself. This is before any significant news about we were waiting. I was just hoping.
Right, yeah.
And my first reaction to the guy was that he was completely unguarded. And he always maintained eye contact. Mm-hmm. And there was that certain sparkle in his eye.
Mm-hmm.
And... there's some people like Norman Lloyd, whom you say, when I get to be 90 something, I would like to be kind of like these guys.
Right.
I would like to hope I could be that.
Yeah, absolutely.
And Scotty's one of those guys.
Yeah.
He just has that glimmer.
95.
And he was walking until not too long
ago. He broke his hip, and he should be doing more physical therapy than he is because he's stubborn, and he was
a
Marine.
Fall or something like that?
He had a fall, and he's a Marine, and he walked on a broken hip for 2 weeks and then didn't know it was broken, but he had a hip replacement with no complications, but he's stubborn and he should be doing more physical therapy, where all of us who love him are riding him to do more physical therapy. So he's,
that's how,
but he's still driving.
Actually, when she broke her hip, and they gave me, they say to, at a certain age, you know, some people of that age, they can't really survive surgery.
Right.
Do you want to have surgery or not?
Right.
And I said, well, in other words, she's in a bed for the rest of her life.
Right.
Or surgery.
Right.
So I said, yes, I think it's better to.
Right.
And she didn't survive.
He did.
Yeah.
He's got an amazing constitution. Yeah. I just wish he'd do more physical therapy. Because I think he'd be walking if he did.
What I was dying to hear, and I have a full service, but I don't. But I wanted to read more. I guess it's in the book about what actually happened at Iwo Jima, what he went through. I was dying to hear more of that. My father was at Iwo Jima.
Yeah, he talks about the war a lot, and it's a big part of his story. I think that an essential part of the story, and I put it in the movie in the first act and in the third act, right, is the Second World War. And the odyssey of a then 17-year-old boy who enlisted, went off the farm to San Diego to train, and then goes to the South Pacific. This is the American narrative of the second half of the 20th century, of which I think he's emblematic. He happens to get out of the Marines and lands, like so many people did, in California, in his case, Los Angeles. And instead of trying to get a part in pictures or becoming, worker for McDonnell Douglas down in Long Beach, he got a job in the gas station and made it into a covert brothel. Why not? I mean, he was doing that before the war. He felt comfortable doing it, clearly had a talent, and he saw a niche market for it. So he invented the drive-through brothel, which is as much an innovation as Ray Kroc's McDonald's, I think. It's quite remarkable, isn't it? I mean, but he himself says this really only could have happened in Los Angeles and specifically Hollywood. The geography was right. It's a car town.
Yeah.
People had to get from the studios in Hollywood back across town normally to Beverly Hills. The gas station was on the way. Everyone needed to go there. Or some gas station, and it was the perfect cover from the Vice Squad. And the Vice Squad, as you know, was rampant and was really a sexual Gestapo, run by the LAPD to shake down gay people.
Yeah.
And he was aware of that, and I think he's very heroic for being so brave and flouting. Flouting it with them. They circled the gas station for years, and he evaded arrest.
Knew that something was.
I think there was suspicion. He says they used to come by and question him, but he's a clever guy.
Right.
You know, I mean, he was a hustler. Sounds pejorative, but he was sort of the good-natured hustler from an early age, going to downtown Chicago and. As a really poor kid, not only plying his trade at an alarmingly early age, but also selling newspapers, shining shoes, selling candy bars. I mean, I call him the all-American boy, except he tells us the part that a lot of the rest of them left out.
If I was Scotty's significant other, I would say they have three homes, right? Three bungalows.
At this point, they have two, but they had three.
Yeah. I would say, okay, one can be the pack rat house.
Right.
Go at it.
Yeah.
And the other, however, I want it cleaned up.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's not a thing against you, Scotty. It's just
right.
I want to live in a certain way.
Right.
Has that ever been discussed? Because people were saying, that's curious that he insists on living that.
Well, I'll tell you the whole story. He never really had a home of his own. He bought the house for his previous common law wife, Betty, on St. Andrews. And
from whom they had the daughter.
Yes, and he barely lived there because he was a hustler, and he was spending nights around town with a different guy every night. Each client had their own night of the week at a certain point. he would do up to 6 tricks a day, he told me, and then spend the night at a client's house. He wasn't at that house. So that was the house of his common law wife and their daughter. Then when he married Lois in the early 80s, she had an apartment in the Valley, which was her apartment. Then at the same time, he was really in a kind of common law gay marriage with Beach Dickerson, who had the house on Kew Drive in Laurel Canyon, which Scotty inherited. Now, all of his pack ratting was in storage units before that, because none of these places were his own. The minute he inherited his own house, which is was Beach's house, and Lois moved in there, because if you've ever seen the view from up there, it's the best view in all of Los Angeles.
That's where the hole in the...
It's truly the greatest view in the city, a city of great views. So it was a very glamorous address. Lois moved in there, but for the first time, it was Scotty's home. And Scotty then, I think as the hoarder will do, started to load it up. And Lois was... Betty died, so there was no one living in the other house. That's the kind of... the awkward truth of the whole thing. Sorry, man.
I was just kind of wondering if there are any, if you were planning any extras that we have not seen in the film that will be on a Blu-ray, which I presume is going to be part of the package.
I'd love to do it. I mean, we had 300 hours of Verite and another 300 of archival. So it's a 94-minute film without credits, I think. So I'd love to. We left the whole Tyrone Power act out. I mean, there's a Tyrone Power section in the first act that didn't make it.
Well, he joined a three-way, right?
Yeah, in the book, it's in Scotty's book, but there was much more to it. He met Tyrone Power in San Diego during basic training in the war, and they had an affair at the San Diego Hotel. And then there were other people involved, and many more than are in the book, apparently. There were women and other guys. And Tyrone Power is very sexually athletic, apparently, and not, and various in his tastes. So anyway, Tyrone Power being a major movie star and being one of the great, talk about, you know, someone with a butch persona. I mean, he was a swashbuckler.
Late 30s to early 50s or mid 50s.
Yeah. Right. Fantastically handsome guy, died young. I wanted that in the movie, but we found that the first act was dragging, so we had to take something out. So that could be in an extra DVD extra that we did, if we, and I'd love to do it. But there were.
Your distributor is not necessarily committing to a Blu-ray with extras yet?
Haven't had the discussion yet.
Not to mention the audio track. I can't wait to hear that.
Thank you. I worked hard on all of it. I chose almost all of those songs myself, and I'm very proud that we were able to get the rights to so many.
Now, I presume that you got one of my favorite parts of the last part of the film are the skunk and raccoon shots,
right,
which I presume... some kind of video that was triggered by movement or something? You just kept cameras going?
Yes and no. We shot it with our normal camera, and we also left a GoPro out for a while. But Scotty had so domesticated the skunks and the raccoons by feeding them that they arrived almost as soon as he got home. They would arrive because he had them trained. And he spent probably more money on the high-end cat food for them than he did on his own food.
Is the little hole in the sun porch fixed at this point?
No, the hole's still there. I'm surprised at how many people are concerned about the hole being fixed. It's not been fixed yet.
I love that he gets up on the roof and does the handiwork at his. That's one of the things I love about the guy.
This is the key, actually, is that he was not just the kind of sex date of choice for these exalted figures like George Cuke or Cole Porter or Cary Grant. He did handyman work for them, too. I mean, he was really the trusted guy in their lives who would, you know, fix the wiring in the house or trim the trees or go pick up someone from the airport. LA being such a sprawling city, and these houses need upkeep. If you've ever lived in LA in a house, you know you need kind of, even a modest house, you need kind of an army of workers around.
Awesome.
And it helps to have one person. And because anyone that has tried to have five different people service their house, you know, it's like it's a full-time job practically. And a lot of these guys, I'll tell you how this all makes sense actually. These guys, they're mostly gay men, they were wealthy so they had help, but they didn't have spouses. And frequently the spouse is the one that supervises all of the workers that help keep up these estates, because George Cukor is busy. He doesn't have the time for this. He's directing, you know, multiple pictures a year. Scotty was the one who did that. And people have said to me, oh, you know, George Cukor was so elegant and sophisticated. Why would he want to hang out with this grease monkey from a gas station? I'm telling you, that's exactly who George Cukor wants around. Not only was he bringing over Marines and bringing himself over, but if the tree needed trimming, George Cukor just had to whisper that and it would be done. That's exactly who George Cukor wants around. And also, look at the old pictures of him. He's very good looking.
That's another question that comes to mind as you're watching. Everybody who has hung with the movie community, if they have any visual appeal at all, it would be very easy to suddenly turn up as in a supporting role, a cameo.
Right.
You know, get a little, get your SAG card, get a little income on the side. Yeah. That never was offered to Scotty.
It was offered to him, he says, and he rejected it. He didn't want it. It's very him. I think he probably, first of all, wasn't that interested. He's not captivated by films. He didn't go to see movies. He's not a fan. I think famous people don't want fans exclusively around them. I think it's a huge plus to not be starstruck when you're around a famous person. To speak to them like an average Joe is probably incredibly appealing, not to mention sexy for them, you know, to alluring to have this cute Marine not fawning over them and not also wanting anything from them.
Not hungry for a job or anything.
Yeah, I mean, they're every day there people are coming up to them, you know, at the Brown Derby asking them to get them a part in pictures. What a relief to have the one person who could be cute enough to, you know, make it in a cameo or a supporting role just not ever bring it up.
It still seems a shame. I just would have loved if Scotty had been in one little Ida Lupino film in the 40s, or, you know?
Ida Lupino would have been perfect.
She would have been just great, you know? The Hitchhiker or something. You know?
Yeah, I can't remember what I asked him about Ida Lupino, actually. Was John Dahl in one of those movies? Because John Dahl was one of the kinkier clients.
Oh, really?
I think he was in one of those Ida Lupino film noir.
I just associate him with Gun Crazy.
Is that's not Ida Lupino, right? Someone else.
Now I'm forgetting who it is.
Yeah. He was the wild one, apparently.
Oh, really?
Okay. Yeah, he would be asked to be hung upside down from a tree in a canyon during a rainstorm or something like that. It was just like, didn't know that was a thing.
The way he reads his lines as the Roman in Spartacus.
Does it give away something? I'll have to go look.